The United States Court of International Trade is now in session. The Honorable Gary S. Katzmann presiding before court number 23-00131. Captain Demir et al. Versus the United States et al. Will the attorneys please state their names for the record, starting with the plaintiff?
David Simon, Law Office of David Simon, representing plaintiff Kaptan. I'm accompanied by my wife and partner, Iowa Simon, but I will be handling the argument.
Morning.
Morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. Kelly Geddes for the United States, and I'm joined by Mr. Purdy on behalf of the Department of Commerce. Good morning, Your Honor. I'm Maureen Fortune of Wiley Ryan on behalf of Defendant
Intervenor,
the Rebarging Action Coalition.
Good morning. You may be seated. So I understand that counsel have agreed to the following allocations of time, that Mr. Simon, you will have 25 minutes.
Yes, Your Honor.
And for the government, Ms. Geddes, 20 minutes. And for the defendant intervener, is that your bag over there? No, flight bag?
No.
No, because I know you come in from Maine, right? Fine, as a matter of fact. 5 minutes, right? And I will state at the outset that, as is my custom, I will give the parties the opportunity post-argument to submit a filing that would be due on June 20th of not more than 1,250 words. So if there are matters that come up during the course of the argument here that you wish to develop, this is your opportunity to further do that. So I should also say at the outset, as the counsel knows, the court has tried to accommodate the various scheduling interests of the parties by providing additional time for consideration of the oral argument questions. We'd also like to acknowledge that the parties have cooperated as well, and we appreciate that. So let's begin with the arguments, Mr. Simon.
May it please the court, again, I'm David Simon, representing the plaintiff, Kaptan. Your Honor, we have two issues here today. We have an issue concerning the exemption from a certain tax on foreign exchange transactions, and we have an issue concerning the reliability. Commerce is finding that a report that Kaptan submitted concerning the land valuation for a benchmark purpose, Commerce had found that report to be unreliable. And that issue is before the court today. We're not asking the court, we don't expect the court to rule on the merits of the BITT exemption or the merits of which land report should prevail. The issues are much more confined than that.
Now, with respect to your saying that you're not asking that the court rule on the merits of the BITT exemption. Is that because you think that the matter should be remanded?
Yes.
So on the question of de jure specificity.
Yeah. The issue on we're not asking the court to rule that the program is not countervailable. I think that goes beyond the briefing. It goes beyond what my expectation is. The issue that we are here to discuss is whether Commerce applied the correct test in deciding that the subsidy was de jure specific. Mm-hmm. If they did not apply the correct test, then I believe the appropriate action is for the court to send it back and tell them to apply the correct test. Likewise, on the land benchmark, if Commerce's let's call it evidentiary test, the test that they applied to decide that the report was unreliable, inadmissible.
Because allegedly it was prepared for the with litigation in mind.
I mean, they have basically three reasons why, and I can address them now or in a minute. But
yeah.
the fundamental issue is reliability, and if Commerce made its decision as to reliability on a wrong basis, then I think the appropriate pathway is to remand and say, Commerce, you have to assess the reliability by truly looking at the report and not just accepting things at rote. That's just an overview.
Sure.
To go back to the BITT, you have our position, of course, in writing, and the principal purpose of the oral argument, as I understand, is to address statements made by opposing counsel. At the outset of all that, you raised what I thought was a really interesting question about enterprise or industry. And I think one thing that gets lost in these cases a bit is that trade law is about stuff. It's about goods. And if some foreigner makes movies and sends the movies to the United States, that's not a product. We're talking about goods that have a harmonized tariff code, that are produced and have an SITC code or whatever that systematization of industries is. We're always talking about goods. That's why it's enterprise or industry, not enterprise or sector. Sector can be something broader, the banking sector, the film sector, blah, blah, blah. But enterprise or industry, it always means goods. What's the petitioner? The petitioner is the domestic industry that produces subject merchandise. So we're always talking about goods. There are places where the commerce and the courts, and I believe also the SAA, kind of talk about the economy of the foreign country, but I really think the focus is on the productive sector of the foreign country. It was an interesting, to me, question. I hadn't really thought much about it in depth before, but it seems to me the whole trade law is about goods, not anything other than goods. If it doesn't have an HTS number, we're not interested in it.
Mm-hmm.
On the BITT, the defendant says that eligibility for industrial registry certificate is not equivalent to actually obtaining a certificate. That's their core proposition. And as you may remember, and I gave these in attachment A, attachment 1, to the comments that I filed, so it would be easy for the court to find them. The BITT, the tax exemption, is defined as excusing a tax on foreign exchange transactions undertaken by certain entities. And the first three of those are not very interesting to us in the context of the trade law. There's an exemption for banks that are doing foreign exchange transactions. They are exempt from the foreign exchange transaction tax. There's an exemption for foreign exchange sales to the Ministry of Finance. Okay, that's not very interesting to us. There's an exemption for the foreign exchange, purchase of foreign exchange in order to pay off foreign currency loans. So if I'm in a company and I buy, have a dollar loan and I need Forex to pay off that loan, that's exempt from the tax. Okay? And those have, if we think about them in the terms of our statute of express exemptions, there's no industry that's exempt from anything there in any rate. But the fourth one is the most interesting. What's exempt is foreign exchange sales to enterprises with industry registration certificates. And the government says, well, not everybody has an industry registration certificate. Maybe. And, you know, I think we have an analogy. Our government in Maryland or New York says, if you want to drive a car, you have to have a driver's license. So everybody is supposed to have a driver's license. And we operate on the assumption that all these drivers on the road have driver's licenses. But there are some scofflaws who drive without a license. That's the kind of people that the government is saying, maybe some people don't have industry registry certificates. We're not interested in them. They don't change the availability criterion. You're supposed to have, as a matter of law, an industrial registry certificate, and everybody does. And if there are a couple of scofflaws out there, okay, so be it. But that's not an express exclusion under the statute. And we have that industrial registry certificate law also in the same attachment. And just to, the pros of this is as broad as it can possibly be. Places that produce or obtain a material continuously and in series by changing the characteristic shape, precision, or composition of a substance, or by processing these substances with the help of machinery, equipment, looms, tools, or other means and forces, or only by manual labor, and the places where the mines are extracted and processed by are considered industrial enterprise. And in the second paragraph, establishments that carry out continuous and serial repairs and plants that produce electricity or other energy, large construction sites such as shipbuilding, and enterprises that produce information technology and software are included in this article. So our statute says in 771-5A-D1, where the authority providing the subsidy or the legislation pursuant to which the authority operates expressly limits access to the subsidy to an enterprise or industry, the subsidy is specific as a matter of law. It's the only provision we're talking about with regard to the BITT. We're not talking about sub 2 of that. We're only talking about that. So the question is, does the Turkish statute expressly, on its face, in its words, limit the application of the subsidy to certain enterprises or industries? Does it expressly limit access to the subsidy? And the government takes the position that the subsidy itself, that is to say, the exemption from the tax, is expressly limited only to the people who get the exemption of the tax. But they're looking at the wrong place. The subsidy itself, the program, is different from who qualifies for the program. Who qualifies for it is, inter alia, all entities with industry registrations, which means the entire industrial sector, the entire productive sector of the economy. So by looking at the program rather than who is for whom for whom is the program available, if you look at the program itself, that's the wrong place to be looking for an exemption. You should be looking at the entities that are covered by the program, the entities that may get the tax exemption, or in my analogy, the people who can drive a car.
So just to be clear, looking at the statute, 19 U.S.C. section 1677, 5A, D.I.,
mm-hmm.
right, or D.1.
Mm-hmm.
Is it your argument that the BITT exemption is specific because it is limited by, quote, the authority providing the subsidy, end quote, mm-hmm. or by, quote, the legislation pursuant to which the authority operates, or both?
In first place, it's my argument that the subsidy is not, the program is not de jure specific. Okay? Because there's nobody that's exempt from it.
Mm-hmm.
Under the piece of the Turkish statute that applies to in industries,
mm-hmm.
enterprises or industries as we understand those terms, which is part four of the statute, everybody with an industrial registry certificate, mm-hmm. the statute, the BITT exemption has to be read in conjunction with
mm-hmm.
the industry registry law, because it explicitly cross-references the law.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the law that says whether anybody is exempt or not.
Mm-hmm.
And there is nobody that's exempt. Every industry is subject to the industry registry law, just like every driver has to have a license,
mm-hmm.
just like everybody has to pay taxes.
Mm-hmm.
And the industry registry law goes, I mean, it has teeth to it, too. It's obligatory to be registered in the industrial registry. Industrial enterprises must pre-register with the registry before starting production activities. To be issued business and working licenses, the letter stating they are registered is sought by administrations that issue business and working licenses. So you can't do business without an industrial registry without industrial registration, period. Everybody, the entire industrial sector, if you will, it's mandatory. It's very different, by the way, from the Pike from Oman case
mm-hmm.
that opposing counsel cites, because in the Oman case, their equivalent exempted extractive industries, oil and gas and mining. Oman is a Gulf state country, and those are very big industries there. And if you exempt them from industrial registration, that's a big deal. We don't even ask about, in the de jure analysis, we don't ask, is it a big deal?
Well, let me ask you this, hypothetical. Suppose a foreign country's legislature enacts a statute providing for a, quote, cash subsidy to the widget industry.
To
the widget industry,
okay.
Right? This is, you know, really pursuant to the oral argument responses. Then suppose that the country's executive misreads this statute and invokes it to give a cash subsidy to every business in the country. Is this subsidy specific as a matter of law and therefore counter available under 1677-5?
It is the jury, not specific, but it is de facto. Let's see. No, I'm sorry. I switched things around. You're saying the law gives it to one industry and the king gives it to everybody?
Well, it's the law provides for a cash subsidy to the widget industry.
The widget industry.
Then the country's executive misreads this statute and invokes it to give a cash subsidy to every business in the country. Is this subsidy specific as a matter of law and therefore counter-available under 1677-5?
Of course, it's very far from our case, but I think it is specific as a matter of law because on its face it only applies to one industry, but I think the petitioners would come in and say, yeah, but it's been given to more than one industry. And then if it's in fact given to everybody, I'm really reluctant to go down a path where the government is not applying its own law.
So would you read 19 U.S.C. 1677-5AD to suggest that a subsidy that is distributed to every business in the country could be countervailable as a specific subsidy?
No, to the contrary. D1 says if a subsidy is available to everybody, it is not specific. As a matter of law, it's generally available. And therefore not countervailable.
Okay.
If I may, I'd like to turn to the land valuation issue.
Yeah.
But I'm happy to pursue this further if you want.
No, please turn to the land valuation.
Okay. And I'll be very brief about that. The Commerce Department held that the Collier the Cushman and Wakefield, we commissioned a report from Cushman and Wakefield.
Right.
Commerce held that it is unreliable. Unreliable, in effect, means inadmissible. We won't use it. It's trash. And why is it unreliable? They have three reasons. Number one, because it was commissioned for the purposes of this case. Well, if you follow the precedent that they cite, the Federal Circuit Sand case, that says that documents that were created around the time of the invention for purposes of litigation should be examined carefully. It doesn't say they're inadmissible. It doesn't say they're unreliable. It just says they need to be examined carefully. I think the entire Sand case is not a good place to do an evidentiary analysis in a trade case, but that's another question for maybe another piece of conversation. The second thing that they say is we don't use confidential reports, BPI, Business Proprietary Information Reports. That's just wrong. They use them all the time. And they're good at using BPI information. I mean, three-quarters of our responses are BPI. So I take it as disingenuous to say that. And their third point is that somehow the data in the Cushman report in our report were corrupted by the presence of government leases. And they say that because the petitioner told them that's the case. And if you look at the report, if they look at the report, they will see that public leases are in one column of lease values, private leases are in a separate column of lease values. They're different. They're separate. But because they didn't even open the report, they don't know that. They just took the petitioner's claim at face value. So their evidentiary basis for throwing out the Cushman report is just wrong. It's arbitrary and capricious. It's not supported by substantial evidence. And we ask the court to remand it with an instruction to consider the reliability of that, to reconsider the reliability of the Cushman report.
Now, you cite the Rutte-Taruki-Oi case for the proposition that Commerce's automatic exclusion constitutes an abuse of discretion. But in that case, Judge Rustani held, the quote is, this error is particularly grievous given that there is no other evidence in the record to the contrary, and that Commerce's countered the expert's report with only its own unsubstantiated assertions to the contrary. In this case, the argument might be Commerce countered the Cushman and Wakefield study with the Collier study. So doesn't Commerce's reliance on the Collier study, if reasonable, mean that Commerce's burden to explain its rejection of the Cushman and Wakefield study is lower than its burden in the Rutte-Taruki case?
No, I disagree with that proposition. In order to reach the point of comparing the two reports, you have to consider them as evidence. But Commerce just threw the Cushman report out as unreliable on its face because it was prepared for purposes of the review. And the Sand case and the Sand case is enough to tell us that what's required is to consider it and determine whether, because in the actual Cushman report, there is a big description of their methodologies and of the standards under which the report was prepared. And if you're going to ignore that, then you're doing something fundamentally unfair. You're throwing out the report without even seeing whether it was prepared in a proper way.
Now, has the Sand case, in your view, been applied in a trade context in a way that you think made sense?
Certainly not here, because Commerce took the Sand case, which is a rule of reason case. Let's look at analyze the evidence and consider whether it's reliable. They took that and converted it to an exclusion rule. That's wrong. That's not Sand. That's not what Sand stands for. The other application of the Sand case in that Canadian, I don't recall it clearly enough at this moment. I'll address it in my post comments if that's all right. But I just think it's wrong to the whole patentability. You know, there's a guy sitting in his lab and he comes up with a patent, and the guy at the next bench is doing things. And I mean, it's totally different from a trade law context where we've got events. We don't flowing over time. We don't have a precise event like the creation of an invention. And I just think they have taken Sand out of, they have taken the Sand test out of context and then failed to apply it.
Counsel, I think your time is up.
I see that.
Thank you for your argument.
Thank you.
And I think, Mr. Gold, did we allot 2 more minutes?
Yes,
Your Honor. Yeah, right. Thank you. So the government?
Good morning, Your Honor.
Yeah.
And may it please the court. Hmm. Before getting into the weeds, I'd just like to emphasize one.
As opposed to into the sand?
And before getting into the sand.
That's very bad.
Yeah. I want to emphasize 2 points that I don't want to get lost throughout the argument. First, with respect to the question of de jure specificity, the guiding rule here is the plain language of the statute, which says that an exemption is de jure specific if, quote, the legislation pursuant to which the authority expressly limits access to, the legislation expressly limits access to the subsidy to an enterprise or industry or a group of enterprises or industries. And here, that question can be resolved simply looking at the Turkish law that says one of these 5 criteria must be met, and they have to conduct foreign transactions in order for there to be anything to be exempt from. So Kaptan is really facing the uphill battle of showing that not simply showing that the exemption is broadly available, but showing that it's somehow so broadly available and these 5 criteria somehow so empty and meaningless that it's unreasonable for Commerce to conclude that the subsidy is expressly limited at all. And that simply goes against the plain language of the statute as applied to the subsidy in this case. And the one thing I'd like to emphasize as far as the land benchmarks go is we're really deep into the territory of Commerce's discretion here. Commerce looked at these reports holistically. It considered various factors, not bright-line rules, but preferences that it has, aspects that it uses to weigh how reliable it considers something to be. And only after bringing several observations that led it to have concerns about the reliability of this report did it conclude that it found the report unreliable. The court should not substitute its judgment for the judgment of Commerce here. It was well within Commerce's discretion to find, based on a totality of its review, that it did not want to rely on this evidence.
We'll go back to that later, but with respect to the sand application here, Kaptan argues that it's really applicable in the patent context, but not in the context of this case. What's your response to that?
Well, we're certainly not arguing that this is a binding authority that governs this case as a matter of law, but it is a principle that is reasonable and that has application here. And that principle is, it's not simply about the contemporaneousness of the evidence. It's about the fact that when evidence is prepared by a private party specifically for the purposes of trying to win an adversarial proceeding, that raises a huge risk of inherent bias. And we see this all the time when parties bring in experts. Anyone can find an expert who's going to take their side.
So you know, in that situation, is it not up to the court to decide, or perhaps even the agency, you know, to consider, yes, there are some potential biases in this report because the argument is that it was prepared for the purposes of litigation. But that being so, that would not result in the automatic exclusion of that report, but a consideration of a variety of factors in determining whether it's reliable.
Precisely, Your Honor, and that is what Commerce did here. Commerce acknowledged the high risk that a report prepared for the purposes of an adversarial proceeding would be biased. It also considered the fact that the entirety of the report was confidential and would therefore be difficult to discuss or cite to in its public-facing documents, going against a preference for transparency in government action. And finally, it did look at the contents of the report, and it saw that it it looked as though it was relying on some evidence that was coming from non-private sources, and Kaptan seems to acknowledge this in the response to its oral argument questions, and it claims that that information was all clearly segregated, but it offers little support for that idea. The fact is, Commerce looked at the report, saw that some of the evidence seems to be government rates, and the whole point here is finding a rate to compare to a government rate that might be at less than fair value. And it was only after weighing all three of those considerations that Commerce determined that the report was unreliable. So yes, the fact that it was prepared for the litigation did not automatically disqualify it. And the language in SANS saying that when something is prepared for litigation, it must be scrutinized, that's a warning. That means it must be scrutinized rather than taken at face value. It doesn't mean it must be scrutinized and you must find further evidence of unreliability. That principle doesn't suggest that Commerce cannot find that the fact that it was prepared for litigation in combination with other factors is enough alone to find the report unreliable. If anything, it's the opposite. It's a warning that if the government wants to go a step forward and rely on something prepared for litigation, it must scrutinize it in order, in acknowledgement of that high risk of bias.
In your view, and we've read your filings, but if you had a home run case regarding SAND and its application in the trade context, what case would that be?
I don't know that I would say we have a home run case. I believe SAND was relied on in the circular welded pipe case, which basically did the same thing that we're trying to do here. It applied that logic to another context. It gave Commerce reason to hesitate before relying on material that was prepared for the purpose of the proceeding. And that just simply goes to show that this is a general principle of reason that does apply in this context. It's not to say that there's no legal or factual differences between a patent case and a countervailing duty case, which of course there is. But it is a sound principle, and in this case it was just one of three reasons that Commerce used to defend its decision. And again, at the end of the day, the question is whether Commerce's holistic review and its decision based on all the evidence that this report was unreliable was so unreasonable as to constitute an abuse of discretion, and that's simply going too far.
And with respect to the BPI confidentiality question, are there not ways in any event to discuss the substance of a report, even if it's in some ways shielded under a confidentiality umbrella?
Yeah, I'm not sure that it would be entirely impossible to allude to the contents of the report, but part of the issue here was that whereas the report Commerce did rely on did have some underlying data that was confidential, but in this case, essentially the entire report is confidential. So combining the fact that nothing about the report can be really publicly discussed in any detail or publicly examined, combined with the fact that it was prepared by a private party for the purpose of the litigation, and the fact that some of the evidence that it relied on seems to be from sources that wouldn't be helpful in trying to determine a benchmark to compare to a government rate because it seemed to be coming from non-private sources, all of that evidence taken together was the reason. So yes, perhaps Commerce could have, if this was the only report on the record and the only issue was that it was all BPI, I'm sure Commerce could have done its best to try and be as transparent as possible while relying on a report that is entirely BPI, but it would undermine the general interest of being transparent and allowing public scrutiny of agency decisions. And so as one reason among several to discount this report, it was certainly a valid reason.
If we could return to the subsidy issue, and you make a distinction between the use of the subsidy and the eligibility for a subsidy. Why does analyzing the factual breadth of eligibility not also belong to an analysis of de facto specificity?
It would also be relevant to a de facto discussion, but the reason that it is relevant in addition in the de jure analysis is because the statute doesn't simply say that anyone who's eligible for an industrial registration certificate gets an exemption. It's only those who actually have a certificate. So it's not a question of whether the government is giving the subsidy to everyone who's eligible. It's the question of who's eligible in the first place. And Captain made this a point of dispute by arguing that even though the statute seems to facially limit it to parties that not only conduct foreign transactions, a criteria that Captain seems to avoid discussing, but also one of these five criteria, one of which is the possession of an industrial registration certificate. So to try and get around that kind of facial limitation, Captain argued that this industrial registration certificate is so broadly possessed that it doesn't really amount to an express limitation at all. But there's a number of problems for that. I mean, first, again, where the statute is so clear that there are criteria that someone has to meet to get this exemption, it's really the burden of proof is on Captain to show that those criteria are so broad as to be essentially meaningless. But in addition to that, Captain starts with the argument that industrial enterprises are broadly defined in Turkish law. That might be true. Maybe they are very broad, but that does not mean they're so broad that they're not a subset of all existing enterprises or industries. Then it's on top of that that Captain says, well, it's very broad, and they should all have industrial registration certificates. Maybe that's true, but that doesn't tell us that they all do. I generally do assume that other drivers have their driver's licenses, but it's context specific. There are other laws that are less broadly enforced. People jaywalk all the time. There are some laws that are broadly enforced. There are some laws that are not. And we simply don't have the information to know whether a law saying that all industrial enterprises should have these certificates means that in practice they all do. But that's on top of the fact that industrial enterprises may be broadly defined, but they are still not all enterprises or industries. They must have the certificate, and they must conduct foreign transactions. And only when all those criteria are satisfied are they eligible for this exemption. It's worth noting that NER, the company at issue here, didn't even get the exemption because of its possession of an industrial registration certificate. We don't know whether they have a certificate or not. They actually met one of those other four criteria, which we haven't been discussing much because Captain is not arguing that those are so broad as to render the exemption not expressly limited. But at the end of the day, with all these different criteria and limiting factors, Commerce was well within its discretion to conclude that as a matter of law, this was the juris specific and that Captain failed to show otherwise.
Now, 19 U.S.C. 1677 5A B1 provides that a subsidy is specific as a matter of law where the relevant authority or legislation, quote, expressly limits access to the subsidy to an enterprise or industry. You've been talking about that as well. Doesn't that mean that if the record does not contain sufficient evidence to show that the BITT program was generally available rather than limited to certain companies, Commerce would be required to demonstrate an express limitation? Your argument seems to rely on the existence of an implicit functional limitation based on a theory of limited eligibility in practice.
The express limitation is the Turkish law that says one of these five criteria must be satisfied, and since it only applies to foreign transactions, the law would also only be available to foreign transactions. Those limitations are express limitations. Mm-hmm. It's only when Captain is the one who is arguing that in practice, one of those criteria is so broad as to render the entire statute not expressly limiting, despite the fact that when you look at the statute, it seems clear that it is. Otherwise, why wouldn't it simply say that everybody is exempt from the BITT tax? So it's only once Captain makes this argument that it's in practice too widely available to be considered expressly limited, which perhaps under no circumstances should overcome Commerce's findings when compared to the plain language of the statute. But read generously, they're basically, they're looking at those criteria and saying those criteria do not constitute limitations because one of those criteria applies so broadly. So to respond to that, we have to look at whether it's true that that applies so broadly. And that's where the evidence is lacking. There's no evidence that, again, even assuming that industrial enterprises was broad enough, which it's not, it's a subset. The statute doesn't require it to be a small subset, simply some kind of express limitation. But even getting past that and getting into this question of whether all industrial enterprises have these certificates, the fact that Captain hasn't made that factual showing undermines its argument, which is essentially, I guess, an argument as to how that criteria should be understood. But the law does provide those five criteria, and that is an express limitation.
Now, turning for a moment to the question of de facto specificity, a subsidy is de facto specific if, quote, the actual recipients of the subsidy, whether considered on an enterprise or industry basis, are limited in number. Doesn't that provision seem like a much closer match with Commerce's eligibility-related explanation than the de jure specificity provision?
Well, first off, the fact that the, you know, actual number of enterprises to obtain the certificates would be relevant for a de facto analysis may be true. But even if that's true, and even if that is more at the core of that analysis, it doesn't mean that it's not relevant here. And again, it's only relevant because Captain is the one who's saying that in practice, these criteria are so broad as to not really be express limitations, even though on paper, on the face of the law, they look like express limitations. But also, when you turn to the de facto analysis, what Commerce is really looking for is who, in fact, got the exemption, where this is more of a question of who, in fact, is eligible in the first place. Mm-hmm. And that is based on who obtains the certificate. So the de facto analysis, it wouldn't necessarily even look to how many people have the certificates. It would look to who, in fact, is getting the subsidies from the government. Who knows? Maybe the government gives the exemption to some companies even though they didn't get the certificate they should have. So the question of whether they have the certificate or not isn't actually the core question of the de facto analysis. It's whether they receive this exemption. But yes, I imagine that who has the certificate certainly might come into play there, but that doesn't mean it has no relevance here since Captain has brought that point into dispute. Moving on to some of the court's oral argument questions and Captain's response to them, they suggest today that an enterprise or industry is limited to the productive or the manufacturing sector of the economy. There doesn't seem to be any basis in law for that limitation. Enterprise or industry is a very broad phrase, and here, yeah, I would simply say that the fact that something is broadly available to many kinds of manufacturers does not mean it applies to all enterprises or industries. The limitation that Captain came up to today doesn't seem to have any basis in law or in Commerce's past practice. Captain has also emphasized in its oral argument response that there are no explicit exclusions as to who the BIT exemption applies to, but there's no need for it was comparing it to a case where it was all industries except X industry. But there's no need for that here because it has the limitation on who can apply in the first place. So the fact that there's no explicitly excluded group doesn't mean it's not de jure specific because it's specific as to who's included in the first place. I'd also like to address, in response to question four, they talk about TOSELEC, which is a different case where this court allowed Commerce to take a voluntary remand so that it could reconsider what specific data points it should include in a benchmark. In that case, Commerce had taken the simple average of various data points, without and had made a kind of conclusory remark that it wasn't going to consider whether some data points were more comparable than others. It asked for a voluntary remand, and the court allowed it. What the court did not do was come up with any list of here are the five factors that Commerce needs to take into account. It just provided its reasoning why it was allowing the voluntary remand, and then it gave a simple one-line order remanding for further consideration. So it didn't provide some, I don't remember if it was five, six factors that that plaintiff listed out in their oral argument answers, but there's no multi-factor test, and the facts there were quite different. Here, Commerce considered the reliability of two data sets. It found one unreliable, and it turned to the reliable one, and then it did make an attempt to narrow it based on comparability to the extent that it was able to. Nothing about that is inconsistent with the court's opinion in Toslek. We've already discussed the SAND principle. And, yeah, one other case that I'd like to clarify, in the Ozdemir case was also very distinguishable because in that case, Commerce had a single source of data with various data points, and the court noted that certain data points, which did include Istanbul and nearby areas, deviated significantly from other areas. But in this case, plaintiff isn't arguing that there were data points within the data set that Commerce relied on that would have been more comparable. What plaintiff is arguing for is that its proposed report shouldn't have been considered unreliable in the first place. So to answer that question, Ozdemir is an apposite. And in this case, Commerce was within its reason, you know, as we've discussed fairly exhaustively at this point, to conclude that for after a holistic analysis, after considering various factors that weighed against its reliability, to conclude that it did not want to rely on its report. And that is a decision that's a highly technical and discretionary decision that the court should not disturb unless it's really an abuse of discretion. And here, the three reasons Commerce provided were legitimate reasons, and this was not an abuse of discretion. And yes, for those reasons, we would respectfully ask that the court sustain Commerce's final results here. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Oh, actually, before you sit down, do you want to comment on the driver's license hypothetical?
Which part of the driver's license hypothetical? Yes, I agree that we expect people to have driver's licenses, but I think that there are some cases where we expect people to follow the law. There are some cases that we don't, and we just don't know which one it is here in Turkey. We don't know if everyone in practice really gets these industrial registration certificates, or it's more like, you know, cases like jaywalking where, yes, the law is on the books, but we expect that people are not going to follow it a large number of the time. That's not to say any expectation one way or another about how this happens in Turkey, just that where we have no evidence, we're not going to assume that what seems like an express limitation on paper is in fact not. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Ms. Thorson.
Good morning, Your Honor. Again, I'm Maureen Thorson of Wiley-Ryan for the Rebar Trade Action Coalition. I believe I'm in a very enviable position this morning because Ms. Geddes has amply covered the bases, leaving me with little to do but cheer her on. I have just a couple of points I'd like to make. First of all, with respect to CAPTEN's interpretation of enterprise or industry as I don't disagree that a company is a business, but I don't adopt the position that an enterprise or industry has to be defined to exclude all companies that are not engaged in manufacturing, for example. I would think absolutely nothing strange of someone referring to the banking industry, even though banks do not necessarily create money, create anything. They are a services business or group of businesses, but banking industry is a common term. And I also wonder, if you adopted CAPTAN's definition, if you were looking at a subsidy program that was available, for example, to both rubber tire manufacturers and those providing financial services to rubber tire manufacturers, would Commerce then simply ignore, read out of that law the references to the financial services company or companies? It just doesn't seem like this is a necessary or particularly useful construction to place on these phrases, given the sheer variety of subsidy programs that Commerce can encounter. Second of all, you had asked whether it wouldn't be possible, even if the Cushman and Wakefield report is completely BPI, for Commerce to nonetheless engage with it, because it engages with BPI, in many cases. But benchmarking is different. The agency has expressed a preference for public benchmarks, and part of that is because, as Captan itself has argued, you have to slice and dice and adjust benchmarking data. You don't just accept benchmark reports or benchmark data sources. You need to adjust for comparability. How do you do that, though, if your entire report is BPI? How do you come up with a nice public benchmark if you have a BPI report? Now, Captan has said, well, we gave you two averages that we calculated from the report that are public, one that's based on or includes some government rental prices and one that doesn't. And if you don't like the fact that we have government rental prices in one of those two averages, just ignore that one and use the other one that we gave you publicly. But then we get back to the question of how on earth is Commerce supposed to slice and dice, adjust for comparability, this average that is public, but all the baseline data points are BPI. What if Commerce were to look at it and say, well, there's only one of these prices that we actually think is comparable, and it's completely BPI? What do we do at that point? This is not something that Captan has really considered. And I think this goes to why there's a tripartite stool here that is supporting the agency's treatment of the Cushman and Wakefield report as unsuitable. And each time Captan tries to attack one of the legs, it gets tangled up in another leg. So, with the government prices, that they say ignore those, well, then we have the non-public nature of the report. We also have the fact that I think the SANT principles are, in fact, something you can use easily in the trade context, and you can do it even without referring to SANT. It's I point to the Mosaic case, which we cited in our response brief. There, I believe it was Judge Rustani upheld the Department of Commerce, no mentions of SANT in the opinion, but she said it's reasonable for Commerce to reject a report that was created for purposes of the litigation and say that's not a more reliable source of data than something that was clearly not prepared for litigation and was prepared in the normal course of business. Again, I think we're in a situation where Commerce has amply supported its reasons for rejecting the Cushman and Wakefield report. And
is it your interpretation that that the Cushman and Wakefield report was rejected for reasons quite apart from the fact that it was provided, that it was developed for the purposes of litigation?
Well, there's three reasons that have been given. I don't think any one of those reasons is the only reason, or Commerce would have said that's the only reason and not gone on to elucidate other reasons. But it gave three reasons for rejecting it. This report is completely BPI. We're also suspicious of it because it was clearly created for purposes of this litigation. And it's got government prices in it, which are obviously unsuitable for benchmarking purposes because it's comparing the government's price to the government's price, which is an interesting thing because if one of those government prices was the price at which, Captan had purchased or rented some government land, that would have to be benchmarked because it's not obviously market-determined any government price.
So it would be your position, and I can ask the government as well, that if one were to focus solely on this, a third component of, a government price comparability, that a decision to exclude the Cushman and Wakefield based solely on that would have not been an abuse of discretion.
Well, I don't have that in front of me, Your Honor. I have a completely different set of facts.
Okay.
I see my time is up, so I will let that be the conclusion of my presentation.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much, counsel. Since we're all here, I will give each side 2 minutes, if you want, to respond to what you've heard. Mr. Simon? And we are going to keep it to 2 minutes each.
Thank you, Your Honor. Again, David Simon for Captan. I want to talk about the three-legged stool. The Commerce Department in the ID memo at page 10 says, when evidence has been generated expressly for the purpose of an administrative proceeding, we find that said evidence is, quote, at risk of litigation-inspired fabrication or exaggeration, end quote, which diminishes its weight and results in the evidence being unreliable. That's the, end quote. That's the whole thing right there. These other things, the BPI business and the government leases business, those are throwaway lines, if you will. This is the reason it's unreliable. That's their words. We're in court because of their words, not because of whether we have three-legged stools or whether they could possibly have rejected it for some other reason. Second of all, I take umbrage at the suggestion that another government might ignore its own laws with respect to the industrial registration, just like the city of New York might ignore jaywalking laws. It is not for the Commerce Department or the government of the United States to say, we don't believe the foreign country enforces its own laws. But aside from that, the statute asks whether the statute expressly limits the subsidy to certain enterprises or industries. The statute says you look at our statute says you look at the face of the Turkish law. You don't look at whether you think the Turkish government enforces its laws as well as we do or something like that. That's just an insult. So statute says what it says. If we apply the statute, then clearly the program is generally available.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Geddes?
Thank you. Just a few very quick points. As far as the definition of, Kaptan is arguing that enterprises or industries is limited to essentially manufacturing type industries. That seems to be essential to its argument because the first step to being eligible for an industrial registration certificate is being an industrial enterprise. And that may apply to a very broad group of manufacturers, but it doesn't apply to all enterprises or industries in the economy. I just wanted to flag that Kaptan pulls a definition of industry from a provision, but that is talking about industry as it's used when we're comparing the domestic industry to the foreign exporters. It doesn't have to do with whether a subsidy applies to a specific industry in a country as opposed to being broadly available in the economy as a whole. Responding to Kaptan's point just now, we certainly aren't arguing that we don't believe that Turkey enforces its laws on the books, only that we looked at the statute. It says one of these five particular criteria must be satisfied. We assume that has some meaning. Kaptan is telling us it doesn't. It's actually so broad that it's not limited at all. And so we see the burden of proof as being on them to show that it's really that broad. And one hole in that argument among many is that we don't know if every manufacturer actually obtains this industrial registration certificate, on top of the fact that even if all manufacturers did, that wouldn't mean all enterprises or industries in the economy did, and that would not mean that everybody is conducting foreign business transactions. And if you're not conducting those transactions, then this exemption doesn't apply to you. And finally, I just wanted to take a, I just wanted to emphasize again because that Kaptan has essentially asserted in its oral argument responses that its report cleanly divided private land rental rates from government land rental rates, but it doesn't cite what it's referring to in its oral argument responses, and it looks to me like it's comparing something that's limited to a geographical reason to something that has to do with specifically government rented lands. It's not clear to me that those categories that don't mention the government are necessarily all private sources, and Kaptan would need to do more to prove that Commerce was abusing its discretion by being concerned about the inclusion of those government rates. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Thorson.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just to speak briefly about Sant and what the government said in the IDM here in this case, and they said specifically that contemporaneous evidence prepared in the ordinary course of business is something they find more credible than later developed evidence generated specifically for litigation. This is common sense. This does not appear to me to be an unlawful per se rule where we don't look at evidence. It just says exactly what they said. We think it's more credible to look at contemporaneous evidence of something like what were 2020 real estate values in Turkey. Here's a 2020 report about that, as opposed to a report from much later developed for the litigation well after the review period. And I agree with Mr. Simon that the statute says what it says. And what it says, relevantly, is we're supposed to look at whether the Turkish government has expressly limited access to a subsidy in its legislation. This legislation says here are five types of company eligible for this subsidy. To me, that's expressly limiting the subsidy to those five types of company. Beyond that, the statute doesn't require anything. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. That concludes our argument this morning. I'd like to thank counsel for your very enlightening arguments and for your filings. As mentioned at the outset, if you wish to file a post-argument submission, that would be due on July 20th. June 20th, next week.
I mean, I'll take July.
We'll stick with June, thanks. June 20th, and not to exceed 1,250 words. So with that, we conclude the argument and safe travels. Good to see you all in the courthouse. Thank you.
All right.
This is not our usual courtroom. We prefer the other courtroom with all the records. You know, we have a place where we can, where my interns can view what's going on. We'll be back in our preferred courtroom next time. Thank you.
Court stands adjourned.